This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program this afternoon, how the town of Jasper, Texas struggled to come to grips with racial hatred in the wake of the murder of James Byrd Jr. Journalist Dina Temple Raston stayed in Jasper when the national press went home. Her time in Jasper led her to write A Death in Texas, a story of race, murder, and a small town struggle for redemption. She says the book is about more than racism and a terrible murder. She says it's about the soul of a small town. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dina Temple Raston is a producer for CNN-FN. She has also worked as a foreign correspondent in China, a White House reporter for Bloomberg Business News, and as a correspondent for USA Today. Her book, A Death in Texas, is published by Henry Holt. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Dina Temple Raston, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Was Jasper an assignment?
No, it wasn't, actually. I said during some readings that I had in Texas that the reason I ended up going down to Jasper was all because of Monica Lewinsky. I was a White House correspondent at the time, and everybody was covering the Lewinsky story, and that was sort of a disturbing story to cover. And I heard that whites in Jasper were bending over backwards to make amends for the James Byrd murder, so I just bought a plane ticket and went down there to see for myself.
Oh. How much time did you spend in Jasper?
All told, over 2 years, probably 4.5 months.
Mm.
It actually worked out quite well that I didn't live there as opposed to sort of parachuting in, because I found that there was one stint I had in which I was actually there for about 5 weeks. That things that struck me as odd when I first came to Jasper after 5 weeks no longer did, because I'd gotten into the rhythm of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And coming and going for long weekends over the course of that amount of time, everything still struck me as fresh.
Mm. Interesting. This is how the book opens. I want to share this with readers. It draws one right immediately into the book, the prologue. Death has a way of making even slow people hurry. It scares them into seeing things the way they are instead of the way they wish them to be. Even small deaths people don't expect to notice, or welcome deaths which end hard luck lives or long painful illnesses, sweep mourners backward through the rooms they have been avoiding for years. What were the rooms Jasper had been avoiding for years?
Well, I think that they'd been avoiding the issue of race for some time. They'd sort of come to an uneasy peace, the black community and the white community. It's important to realize that Jasper is in a very isolated part of Texas. It's almost more Dixie than it is Lone Star. And at the time that the James Byrd murder happened, you may remember in 98, the national unemployment rate was around 5 or 6%, and in Jasper it was 17%. So what you had is sort of a great mixture of things that were going on that allowed people to scapegoat other people, and one way they scapegoated them had to do with race.
Mm. Is Jasper a typical small town? How is it like and unlike small towns elsewhere?
Well, I'm not a big Southern reporter. I went down to Jasper. As you had said earlier, I have a background in China reporting. I was a foreign correspondent in China and Hong Kong in the late 80s and early 90s. And so I decided to go down to Jasper and cover it really like a foreign country, because I didn't know a lot about Texas history. And it sort of fit into a lot of the cliches that I had. I'm from Northern California originally.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the cliches I had about Southern towns, there was sort of a patriarch of the town, and we discuss him in the book, Joe Tannehill, who was Jack Ruby's defense attorney with Melvin Belli, and sort of turned out for a long time to sort of be in charge of the power structure in Jasper, and I didn't realize that those things still happened. And there, I had taken photographs of Jasper now, and then compared them, or in '98, and then compared them with what Jasper had been like in the '60s. And the only thing that had changed were the cars. I mean, it looked exactly the same.
Wow. Almost 4 years after James Byrd's murder, is Jasper changed?
No, and without completely giving away the book, I think that's what struck me more than anything, is that When I first started the book, the subtitle on the book is A Story of Race, Murder, and a Small Town Struggle for Redemption. But when I started the book, it was a story of a murder. And then it turned out that really it was about race and murder. And then as time went on, I realized it was actually a book about Jasper's redemption, or its attempt at redemption. And the thing is that there was a lot of sort of antebellum traditions in Jasper that we as Northerners aren't really very aware of. For example, blacks in Jasper could point to someone who was white and say, his people brought my people over. Or someone who was white in Jasper could point to someone who was black and say, oh, my great-grandfather brought his great-uncle over. And when you have that sort of history that's being kept so tightly there beneath the surface, it's kind of hard to sort of get over all those race issues and have equality.
Yeah. When the story of Byrd's murder was in the press on a daily basis, one element of the story was about how the black and white communities in Jasper had come together. But the story is much more complex than that, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, the shorthand way that I've been saying this is essentially what happened is the black and white community in Jasper kind of hoodwinked the national media into thinking that they were racially enlightened. And one of the reasons they did this, again, had to do with Jasper history. There had been some terrible race riots in Beaumont in 1943, which a lot of people in Jasper remembered. And then they looked back at what had happened after the verdicts in the Rodney King trial, and they saw what had happened in Los Angeles. And there was a real palpable fear that that could happen in Jasper, too. So the black and white community got together and said, look, we'll take care of our problems when all the media leaves. But in the meantime, we're going to put our best foot forward. And that's why if you look at any of the photographs or any of the news stories at the time, on the dais there would always be black, white, black, white, black, white community member. And they would always speak in turn. And these sorts of things gave the impression that Jasper had really learned a lot from this. And Jasper probably has learned a little, but there was certainly not any sort of great reformation.
Yeah. The little Jasper has learned, what would you say it is?
Well, I think they're much more aware that they have racial problems. I don't know that they... I think that before the murder, and even in the days after the murder, everybody was incredulous that this could have happened because, gee, everybody gets along in Jasper. And then I think that they looked a little closer and saw, for example, that there was only one black bank teller and that there were very few black business owners. And Jasper population is 50% white, 50% black. And I think that this... sort of galvanized their feelings about race. It didn't fix them, but it let them know that there was, in fact, a problem there.
Yeah.
And I should say just really quickly that the temptation is to point to Jasper and say, oh, it could only happen here. But the book really is meant to have broader themes than that, that what happened in Jasper happened to happen in Jasper, but it could have happened other places as well.
Yeah. That's one thing I'm sure you hope readers will take away from this story.
I hope so, yes. Yeah. I hope it's not too subtle.
No, I don't think it. I think, you know, I think it's a way for all of us to sort of reflect on our attitudes about race.
And that's why the beginning talks about sweeping people backwards through rooms they hadn't been in for years. That's not just Jasper, but everyone.
Yeah. And there's another sentence in the book that I really liked. It's just a very shorthand way of describing Jasper and a lot of other places. Segregation was of the unspoken variety.
Right. Right.
There was only one black police officer in town.
There was one black deputy.
Deputy.
There were in the sheriff's office, but there were black police officers as well, but there was just one black deputy.
Yeah. Has the story affected you personally?
A lot, actually. I was, until recently, the only journalist who had ever spoken to Bill King, who was sort of the ringleader of the trio. And until that time that I started speaking with him, which was in January of 99, and I've had several conversations with him, I'd never actually been in a jail, much less talked to someone who was accused of murder. And at the time, I was trying to explain on television in different medium, that Bill King, what was scary about him was, in fact, that he seemed so normal. So I suddenly became this big apologist for Bill King. I'm a little more media savvy now, I guess, and try and explain myself a little better. But everyone thought I was trying to make excuses for him. And the reason I tell you this story is because then I started having this recurring nightmare that Bill King was released under my recognizance, and I would lose him in the Walmart in Jasper. So it sort of let me know, and I've had that dream a lot. I don't anymore, but I did while I was writing the whole book. And it sort of let me know that it was affecting me on a real psychic level, that I thought something, obviously this wouldn't happen, but that this is one of my concerns.
Yeah. So tell us about your reaction to the jail where you interviewed, the prison where you interviewed.
Well, I decided to go down to Jasper County Jail on New Year's Day in 1999, and Billy Rolls, who was the sheriff then, knew me by then. And I walked in, and it was sort of one of those journalistic Hail Mary passes. I just walked in and said, "Hey, can I try and talk to Bill King?" And Billy Rolls said, "No, he hasn't talked to anybody, not his father, not his lawyer, not his girlfriend, for 6 weeks. He's not going to talk to you." And I said, "Well, you know, you never know. Can I send back a note?" He said, "Sure." So I wrote a note in really sort of loopy, girly handwriting, which is not what I have. I have that sort of perfect little handwriting that you get in Catholic school. But I did the loopy handwriting with big circles over the eyes and said I wanted to learn more about the Aryan pride and the Christian identity movement, and I'd come from Washington, D.C., and would he come out and talk to me? So Billy reads this note. He said it would never work, and I said, "Well, you never know," and he walks it back, and he comes out sort of 30 seconds later with his eyes around his saucers, and he says, "Bill King's going to be in that room in 5 minutes." And I was immediately thinking to myself, "Oh, I wish I'd seen Dead Man Walking. I have no idea what I'm going to talk to this guy about." Mm. And I have sort of this odd thing that if people swear in front of me, all the color drains from my face. Even though I've been a journalist for a long time, this is just one of my little odd quirks. So the odds of Bill King frightening me by, you know, starting to swear at me or get angry at me were so high, I thought the gig was going to be up within 30 seconds. So I walked into the room where he was, and out of my mouth pops the words, "Oh, my God, you look so young." I mean, he looked like he was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And he threw his head back and laughed, and he said, "I am young. I'm only 23. And that broke the ice, and we spoke for an hour and a half, almost 2 hours. And I finally ended the conversation because I couldn't think of what else to talk to him about. But we ended up talking about what it was like growing up in Jasper and what it was like to be in the Texas prison system.
Yeah, that's key here, isn't it? King's hatred of blacks was stirred by his time in prison.
Yes, it's sort of a fine line and a subtlety in the sense that I don't think prison is all that did it. I think that there was certainly a kernel of hate and prejudice in Bill King. But what the Texas prisons, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, are the only prison system in the United States that is under federal oversight because of the number of beatings, killings, and rapes that take place behind bars. So prisons are violent in and of themselves, but on top of that, Texas is even worse. And I think that whatever happened to him there, I mean, he and I have had enough conversations. There's a question of whether he was raped there by a black gang and that sort of thing. Whatever happened to him there took whatever his basest instincts were and allowed them to flourish.
Tell us about William Big Mo Mosley.
Now, I never talked to William Big Mo Mosley, but he was the one sort of character witness for Bill King during the trial. And it's sort of an interesting story because it gives you an idea about the Texas prison system. And he sort of came out in his orange garb, and he was shackled around the ankles and around the wrists while he sort of got onto the witness stand. And he's the one who applied a lot of the racist tattoos to Bill King. He was a tattoo artist in prison. And, of course, his whole testimony was very bigoted and a lot of swearing and that sort of thing. But one of the reasons why a lot of people didn't want to be character witnesses for Bill King is because they were worried about reprisals. And as it turns out, Big Mo, when he went back to prison, was beaten up by prison gangs for testifying on Bill King's behalf. And what they did is they took his hands, and remember he was the tattoo artist, took his hands and put them in one of those vices that you have in a workshop, and broke both his hands, crushed them.
Mosley was a big man, a very just walking into the courtroom and taking his seat in the courtroom. Violence was, I mean, he had an aura of violence.
Yeah, he radiated violence. I think I say something to the effect of the book. It's actually one of my favorite sort of sections of the book, if I have one of those, and that there was sort of this Darwinian sense among people who were in the front rows of the courtroom. They were all sort of leaning back, worried that he would suddenly fly out at them. And the people who were far enough back that they thought they were protected were all leaning forward to try and get a better look at him. I mean, he was very menacing.
Yeah. But what he had to say was really important to understanding this story, as horrible as it was. I mean, I'm with you in terms of it. This is a really, I think it's a really good part of the book. Do you have the book there?
I don't think I have a copy here. Let me see if I have.
Sorry about that. Yeah, because you can kind of, Mosley was, he was this man who was in prison, and he was a tattoo artist, as you say, and he tattooed King's arms as a way of protecting King.
Right, that it was supposed to make King, I guess I should explain that. Oh, yeah. Mosley's this enormous, sort of 6'4", enormous man, and King was, I guess, about 5'9". And, you know, he was a beefy guy, but not big by prison standards. And so one of the ways the defense was trying to protect Bill King, or trying to say that he had all these racist tattoos or these mean-looking tattoos, he was what was called sleeved out. So he was tattooed basically all over the top of his body, right down to his wrist. The reason he had done this was to make himself look more menacing, and it wasn't necessarily, as the prosecution had said, that he was trying to show his racism and his hatred of blacks, but in fact, this was a way to try and get people to leave him alone and think he was tougher than he was while he was behind bars.
Yeah. I have the book here, and if it's okay with you, let me just read it.
I'd love to.
He's on the stand. Mosley's on the stand, and he says, "In prison, there ain't too many people going to ask for butterflies and roses. That sounds kind of gay, don't it?" His response was supposed to bolster the defense's contention that King's many tattoos were not meant to be great inky galleries of racism, but rather were intended to make the baby-faced King appear more intimidating and therefore less vulnerable to rapes or beatings in the unit. Quote, "The double S means you're a wood, W-O-O-D. You stand up for what's yours," Mosley said, interpreting the drawings like a professor deconstructing literature. The ram's head, well, that's not satanic. It just looks cool, that's all. It's not a goat's head. Bill King was just an ink freak. That's the term we'd use. He thought all those tattoos looked cool. Was Bill King a racist? The defense attorney asks, looking up from the yellow legal pad on his table. Mosley nodded. Prison has a tendency to do that to white boys. Cribbs continued, is he proud of his race? Mosley eyed him suspiciously. Shouldn't we all be? Is anything done to protect prisoners from the racial violence in prisons to deter this kind of racist indoctrination?
Not really. I mean, I am not an expert on prisons, and I sort of jumped to say that very quickly because I don't have a way to fix this. But I think that the way I would explain it, having talked to people who are behind bars, it's sort of a Lord of the Flies, William Fielding thing going on, that there's sort of a natural ganging together for protection. And guards, actually, for example, if he didn't stand up for himself, guards actually think the lowest of the low in prisons are those people who won't stand up for themselves, who basically become what they call a hoe, basically a whore that can be rented out for money for the different people who are behind bars. So if you think of it in that way, that guards actually have the same disdain for a hoe as regular prisoners do, that sort of gives you an indication of whether or not they're really trying to stop all this.
Mm. There were two others convicted in the murder, Russell Brewer and Sean Berry. What are their stories? What put them on course to get involved in this crime?
It's interesting because I deal much less with Russell Brewer than I do Sean Berry, mostly because Russell Brewer is not from Jasper. He was from Sulphur Springs, and he was sort of a long-time petty thief, had been dealing drugs, stole stereo equipment from his own family, not a very bright guy. And there's a real question as to whether or not he and Bill King had some sort of romantic relationship, although the way we would see a gay relationship outside prison and the way you see it inside prison are really two very different things. Somehow it's not effeminate necessarily in prison, whereas you might think that outside of prison. And So Russell Brewer was sort of interesting in that respect, in the sense that, and I hope I make this clear in the book, that I don't think that the murder probably would have happened if Russell Brewer hadn't happened to come back to Jasper and sort of stirred up all the sort of prison rhetoric and prison feeling that had been in Bill King. Bill King had been back in Jasper for 6 months, and nothing had happened. There was no violence. Everything was fine. And then Russell Brewer came back, and immediately sort of the scofflaw stuff that they were doing returned. And they were sort of racist together in a clique in prison. And I think that that sort of fired it. You know, they wanted to show how tough they still were. Sean Berry was the manager of the Twin Cinemas in Jasper. And on a good day with Wheaties, probably had a IQ of about 90, not a very bright guy, mm-hmm. and was very jealous of the relationship that obviously King and Brewer had and wanted to be a tough guy like they were. He was very diminutive. He was like 5'6 or 5'7 and very skinny, and wanted to be a big bad guy like these two others with all their tattoos. Of course, this isn't what came out in his defense. This was all a mistake. He shouldn't have been there. But I think that's what the crux of it was.
Why wasn't he sentenced to death?
Well, the way it works for being sentenced to lethal injection in Texas is that you could get out of being sentenced to lethal injection by simply showing that there was a mitigating circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
A mitigating circumstance, for example, in Bill King's case might have been that he was raped in prison. That would have been a mitigating circumstance that potentially a jury could have seen as a reason to not give him lethal injection. That obviously that didn't happen. In Sean Berry's case, Sean Berry wrote a complete confession of what had happened that night and led the police to the chain that had chained James Byrd to the truck, and which was, in a sense, the murder weapon. And a jury seemed to think that that was enough of a mitigating circumstance. I mean, the subtlety here is that for Jasper to have sentenced Bill King to death shows that they were willing to sentence someone who maybe wasn't one of their own, but seemed like one of their own, who had obviously really gone wrong in prison, to death. If they had actually sentenced Sean Berry to death, who hadn't been in prison and didn't have the same sort of racist background that Bill King did, Jasper would have been sort of indicting itself and the environment that was there. So I think that's also part of the reason why Sean Berry got life instead of death.
Hmm. One of the town's leaders, or patriarch, Joe Tannehill,
mm-hmm.
he said, you mentioned him earlier as one of the lawyers who defended Jack Ruby. He said of this crime in Jasper, there are some people in the black community who say this proves that Jasper has race problems, and this doesn't prove anything of the sort. It proves that three drunk boys, and one of them wasn't even from Jasper, committed a terrible murder. Was that pretty much the attitude of whites in Jasper?
Yes.
About the crime?
Yes, and the attitude that was not reported by the national media. The national media really did report the story that Jasperites wanted them to report. And what surprised me was right after Bill King's sentencing, I was hearing from the black community in Jasper that all these things that whites had been doing to sort of make amends and bend over backwards had reverted back to type. And I was hearing from the white community that the black community was getting sort of uppity and taking advantage of what had happened. So the book, actually, after the Bill King trial, actually did a 180, because up until that time, the book was about Jasper's redemption.
Mm-hmm.
And then its redemption was dashed.
Why did the national media get the story, not get the whole story, real story?
I think it's really hard being a daily journalist. I mean, you get what they call the rough draft of history, and nobody could be down there for as long as I was down there to keep checking up and taking the temperature of people down there in Jasper. And I think that's why they got it wrong. And, I mean, I well could have gotten it wrong if, for example, I hadn't continued to be there after the Bill King trial. I might have thought this was a racially enlightened place, too. I think that they did the best they could do as daily journalists who were getting down there to do the story, the daily story. And that's why you want people, I guess, writing books, because they get a longer horizon, a longer view, and can put everything in a historical context.
How have people in Jasper reacted to the book?
It's been kind of mixed. I haven't been down there. I did see some Jasper people when I was at a reading in Houston. And you know, nobody, I think, really likes to be written about. I can't remember the gentleman who wrote this, but you know, the book about Savannah, Georgia, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Apparently the people down in Savannah and the characters who were in that book just absolutely loathed the book and thought that he got it all wrong. And certainly this was my concern when I was putting together the Jasper book. And I happened to be having a small dinner with Joan Didion, the writer who was out of L.A. for a long time and now is in New York. And she writes a lot of nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that the problem with writing nonfiction is that regular people don't know the message that they're sending. Politicians, for example, Clinton, who I was covering at the time, really understood with every gesture and with every word what message he was sending. He was very good at that.
Mm-hmm.
But people in Jasper, just regular people, I might have them absolutely dead to rights, the perfect description of them, perfectly what they said and their quotes and their facial expressions, but they don't see themselves that way. And because they can't see themselves that way and don't know that's the message they're sending, for example, using the N-word and then saying, hey, but you know, down here we don't mean anything by it. You could say that, but it's a loaded word, so of course you mean something by it. That was sort of the problem that I think that came out of the book. And so the white community and the black community in Jasper, they're not angry, but they're sort of grumbling about things in the book that they don't think I got quite right. But the fact that the white community and the black community are equally grumbling makes me think that maybe I got it about right, that I was fair, that if one group or the other group had felt that I was biased, that maybe I got it wrong. But I think I got this pretty close to right.
There were political agendas swirling about in Jasper. The Klan came to town. The Black Panthers were there.
Jesse Jackson.
Hey,
Bailey Hutchinson.
Yeah, and Byrd's children appeared at the Democratic National Convention.
Right.
In Los Angeles in 2000. What are your thoughts about that? Did we have a murder here that got politicized?
Absolutely. And you know, I tried to write a book that wasn't really just journalism, but in fact was novelistic in the sense that there are a lot of sub-themes in the book. For example, the woods are actually, or they're meant to be, a character in the book, sort of a superstitious, sinister character in the book. And this is where all this happened to James Byrd. Similarly, the politicization of the James Byrd murder from within hours after his death to the signing of the James Byrd hate crime law just last year, you know, I describe, and this is stuff that people, even if they were reading the news stories carefully, never heard about at the time. A couple of hours after the James Byrd body was discovered, two different funeral homes in Jasper were fighting over the body. One guy wanted it because he knew there would be great advertising possibilities, because he knew this was going to be big. And then all of a sudden you've got Klan, then you've got Black Panthers, and then you've got Jesse Jackson, who from his pulpit in the city declares Jasper this incredibly racist place without knowing anything that had happened, or that the three people who were accused of the murder at the time had already been rounded up less than 36 hours after the murder, or that Billy Rolls, the sheriff, had called the FBI hate crimes unit right away to make sure that nothing could be covered up or bungled by people who didn't know what they were doing. I mean, that sort of thing. And then you follow this all the way up to, you know, Bill Clinton meeting James Byrd's daughter, you know, at an airport in Austin, mm-hmm. to the Byrds speaking at the Democratic Convention, to the Byrds actually being in ads. In fact, if I were writing a second edition of the book, it would talk about how the Byrd family has actually gotten involved in the mayoral race in Houston by endorsing one candidate or another. And then finally, with the James Byrd hate crimes law, that was signed by, I want to say, Perry, who is the governor who came in after Bush left.
Dina Temple Raston is our guest this afternoon. She's a journalist. She's author of A Death in Texas, a story of race, murder, and a small town struggle for redemption. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. You can join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. Our number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Another thing that we didn't hear reported about this story as it was unfolding in Jasper, that James Burr Jr., like the men who murdered him, had a criminal record. And the interesting thing about this angle of the story is that it's got to complicate how the town feels about that man.
Yes, you've understood this perfectly, and of the different things that I've been criticized for in the book, one of the big things that people keep asking me is, it seems that by bringing up the fact that James Byrd had a longer rap sheet than the three guys who killed him put together, that you're somehow saying it's okay he was killed. And you didn't need to put that in the book. That's gratuitous. And I know that the Byrd family in particular feels that it's gratuitous, talking about how he was the town drunk. But the truth is, exactly as you say, the reason why this is integral to the book is because it complicates the way that Jasper could react to the crime. And in the sense that if James Byrd had been a deacon in the church, Jasper would have merely had to sort of put up a memorial park or a statue and say how terrible this was and not have to really reflect on race issues within the town. They could have sort of whitewashed this. But the fact that James Byrd was difficult to memorialize was huge, because what ended up happening is that the white community wanted to hurry and put up a park. And the black community was saying, hey, wait a minute. This is more complicated than that. We don't want our children looking up to James Byrd. And the way that he was killed is a terrible thing. But we're not going to memorialize him just because of the way he was killed.
It says loud and clear, I think, Dina, that you have to think about what you're memorializing when it comes to memorializing anything.
Right. Right. And again, you know, the key point here is that it made Jasper have to look at itself a little bit longer than it would have otherwise. If James Byrd had been a model citizen, they really could have taken care of this in sort of short order. And instead, there were many more conflicts there.
We've got a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with this caller on the toll-free line, calling us from Chicago. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd like to know, how did they egg him on to get him to go with them, or how did the argument start? Can you go into a little bit of history on that?
Sure. The truth is, in towns like Jasper, if you have beer in the back of the truck, it doesn't take a lot to get somebody to just ride around in the truck with you. I mean, this is what they do for diversions in small southern towns. And James Byrd was drunk when they picked him up, and they just pulled over and said, hey, do you want to ride? And when they were going in the opposite direction of his house, that really didn't strike him as weird, because the truth is, in small towns like Jasper, riding around the back of the truck with beer is as good a diversion as any. Mm-hmm. It's unclear what sparked the actual beating of James Byrd and then eventually the dragging of James Byrd. What I've been able to ascertain from people that I've talked to in Jasper is that James Byrd was a very, very aggressive drunk. I spoke to three different people who saw him stumbling along the road that night and actually had gone down side streets to avoid him so that they wouldn't have to pick him up and take him home, because he could be such an aggressive drunk. This doesn't make anything that happened to him okay, but it does sort of illuminate what might have happened.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. A couple of people I want to talk about before we run out of time. First of all, a key figure in the story, the sheriff, Billy Rolls. At the outset of the book, when the murder is discovered, you quote him. A deputy has just handed him a cigarette lighter found at the crime scene, and symbols for the Klan are etched on it. And he thinks to himself, boy, this country boy's in trouble.
Right.
What would you like to say about the sheriff and how he handled the situation in Jasper?
Well, I mean, Billy Rolls is really, someone else said this in a review, and I wish I'd thought of it, but it really is true. He's the moral center of the book. And the reason, I mean, in a way, Jasper got really lucky that Billy Rolls was their sheriff, because if it had been a different kind of sheriff, say a sheriff who wanted all the glory that might come from prosecuting or arresting people who were involved with the worst racial murder since Emmett Till, or if he was a sheriff who was prejudiced and knew James Byrd's background and had been lackadaisical in any way, or if he'd been a sheriff who didn't feel like he should call the FBI right away to get them in, all these things could have meant that there would be a very different outcome in Jasper, that Jasper would be branded forever as the place where someone got away with this kind of hate crime. The fact that he wasn't like that, and that he was, in fact, a born-again Christian and a really kind of soft-hearted guy and had spent the years of the civil rights movement, not in the South, but instead had been in Montana and in California, where, A, it wasn't as violent, and B, he had learned to mix very easily and comfortably with people of different races. All that came together in the persona of Billy Rolls.
We have another listener who wants to talk with us. Let's talk with this caller in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'm sure that what happened to this gentleman in Texas was not the first, because in the South, I'm from Mississippi. In the South, Mississippi, all of those southern states down there, a lot of people is dead, and they never found out where they was or who did it. Hanging was one part of what the whites did in the South, especially with black men, which they felt that threatened them in certain ways. Also, in my opinion, writing so much about the man that he was an alcoholic, in my opinion, I don't think that was right to put that much in there about him. Just because he was an alcoholic, that doesn't mean that somebody should pick him up. They had already planned what they was going to do with him anyway. When they picked him up, they knew exactly what they was going to do. And just because he was an alcoholic didn't give them a reason to do that. And one more thing that I was going to say something else that but anyway, just believe what I say. I'm from Mississippi. My ancestors, I know a lot of things that went on down south and things. That's why my husband and I got out of there
right.
in 55. When things started getting hot. But I didn't live in the Delta area, but we knew what was going on in the Delta area.
Well, actually, if you read the book, ma'am, there is a lot in the book about mysterious deaths in Jasper and how that was part of the reason why when the James Byrd killing happened, that people in the black community were sure it was going to be covered up because of the number of different crimes that had taken place that hadn't been solved. And as far as James Byrd's background in that he was an alcoholic, it actually, you kind of answer the question itself, that it's important to know that he was drunk that night, because I don't think that Bill King, Russell Brewer, and Sean Berry would have picked him up if he wasn't in a weakened condition. Because these were three guys who were much smaller than James Byrd. James Byrd could have taken care of him in short order if he wanted to, if he had had all his faculties.
Mm-hmm. But just because he was drunk that night, a lot of people get drunk.
Yes, ma'am, and a lot of people are taken advantage of when they are
drunk.
That's why this is so. It doesn't make what happened to James Byrd okay, but I think to understand all the things that came together, you need to understand that, for example, if James Byrd hadn't been walking along the road there and had accepted a ride from James Brown, his friend, that night instead of walking around the road, it wouldn't have happened.
Well, I can understand why a lot of them probably drinks down in Jasper and a lot of places in the South because of the way that they being treated. You don't know what goes on daily down there in the South, especially in the Delta area. Those people are still having problems. In certain areas, those people still act like they acted during the 1920s and 30s, you know. When my mom and dad and all of them and things were scared to say things to white folks, you know, during that time, you know. And my father worked for the Illinois Central Railroad, and they picked on him the whole time he was there, you know. He used to come home and talk about it. That's why I know what's going on. So no wonder that he was probably drinking, and some of the others is probably drinking, trying to cope with what's going on down there. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon, and the caller is absolutely right about the numbers of other racially motivated murders. I mean, it's.
I think I go into that actually in the book. You know, the Ray Peacock killing. That had happened in which mysteriously a guy who had come back from college who was African-American was hit by a car, and there was a question of whether or not it was because he was dating a white woman. I think I go into this also. There's a character named Eddie Land, whom I speak to, who talks about how the unspoken segregation in Jasper makes everybody worried. And his wife actually says, would you ever date a white woman? And he said, no, I'd be found hanging from a tree. So I think I do go into this pretty extensively. I don't just sort of focus on the Jamesburg murder. I think that I try and put it in a broader context and in the environment down there.
Also, there's another important book, in my opinion, out now on bookshelves. It is titled At the Hands of Persons Unknown.
Sure, the Philip Dre book.
Yes, and we just talked with him earlier this week. And it's a history of lynching in the United States.
And how essentially it's become a social gathering as opposed to what I think we see it as today.
And that law enforcement and other authorities were often complicit.
Yes. And this was exactly what they were worried about when it came to James Byrd. I mean, there's Margaret Tookes in the book says, thank goodness his head and his arm landed in a black person's yard. Otherwise, this all would have been covered up.
One more person I want to talk with you about before we go, and that's the newsman who's the station owner of KJAS.
Mike Lout.
Yeah. Tell us about him and how he handled this story.
Well, Mike Lout is sort of a maverick down in Jasper because there's sort of this odd sort of hierarchical system there in Jasper, and he ignores it. And he steps on a lot of toes because there's a lot of things that when you're in a small community, there are a lot of things that go unsaid because it's sort of impolite or it's out of some sort of southern courtesy that you don't talk about things. And while Mike Lout is from Jasper, you know, he's a real newsman at heart. So those things that people don't like to talk about, he does. For example, he was talking about how the fall festival for Jasper, where they sort of sell pies and jams and that sort of thing, was going to fall on the same day that the Klan was going to come for a rally. And so the head of the Fall Festival called him and was very upset that he had reported this on the radio. And he said, well, you know, I think it's best that I did report it because she said, you're just going to ruin the Fall Festival. And his response was, well, you know, if the Klan's there, it's kind of going to be ruined anyway.
Hmm. Well, thanks for telling us the story and telling us the way you see it.
Thanks very much for having me.
Dina Temple Raston has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Her book, A Death in Texas, A Story of Race, Murder, and a Small Town's Struggle for Redemption. The book is published by Henry Holt. Dina Temple Raston is a producer for CNN-FN. She's also worked as a foreign correspondent in China, a White House reporter for Bloomberg Business News, and as a correspondent for USA Today.